Good evening. This is 42 Minutes, a production of Syncbook Radio and thesyncbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. I am Douglas Bowles, and tonight, on this 25th day of June, our expected guest, Mr. Simon Critchley, was forced to cancel his appearance due to a medical situation. 42 Minutes wishes him the speediest of recoveries. Also, we'd like to share that next week's guests, the creative team from the film Radio Free Albemuth, have a Kickstarter that is nearing its end. They are close to their goal, but they need your support. You can find the link to their Kickstarter in the upcoming shows on our website, 42minutes.com, or by simply Googling Radio Free Albemuth. As a special treat, then, this week, we're joined with Andras Jones, Alan Green, for episode number 90, and we're speaking with our old, well, not old, but our dear friend, David Plate.
And we're going into the depths he found in the Imaginarium of Dr. Platypus. Hello, Alan here, and we're speaking with none other than MK Ultrasound, DJ and scholar. David is one of the hosts of the Syncbook radio program Always Record. He maintains the blog The New Creatures Magical Mystery Tour, which can be found at beingthere723.blogspot.com. Last year, he contributed a chapter to the Syncbook Volume 2, of which we will be discussing tonight.
Welcome, David. So I think this is just funny because the direction that I was going to take is I've had kind of a block to reading Andras's book because of the Kabbalistic tree, and now because of your chapter in the Syncbook, it like you opened this whole world to me finally. Finally, your chapter lays it out in such a way that my blockages to going into the tree now, I think, are finally removed. Thank you, David.
Oh wow.
Thank you, David.
You got it. No, I like to hear that. I'm continually relating to the tree in different ways, and I feel like the purpose of that's included in the purpose of the study in the first place is that it's a dynamic thing, and it's not meant to be a rigid concept. It's meant to be something that's continually evolving and developing. And I mean, basically there's certain assumptions that you can kind of assess. One being that, you know, the tree itself is meant to be like an underlying set of dynamics on the other side of appearances. And to be open to that idea or that notion is obviously the first step, but then continuing to look at that and delve into that from different angles is just obviously an ongoing thing. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, so I think the flow of your piece is wonderful because there are these expository moments where you're kind of unpacking the concepts, but then you drop right into the rabbit hole and you'll have these amazing sync paragraphs that are, they're dense, but then they really... You kind of have to just hang on because you get from a number of different syncs, you know, from point A non-linear to point B. And so I really enjoyed it. It's funny because you speak about Apollo and Dionysus, and this is syncing with me because I'm reading Dan Brown and he's doing the same thing. But I feel like your piece is pretty big. You were looking it over today. Is there anything that kind of caught your attention?
Well, I have a quote here. Actually, two quotes combined from their translations from the Zohar. And so with my teacher, that's our main area, is just going over particular sections of the Zohar and commentaries specifically from Ramak, which is... 16th century Kabbalist from Spain who goes really deep into, he'll take a sentence and go on with it for, you know, 30 pages practically. And so lately we've been going into the clephotic tree, which I've had a lot of reluctance in exploring, mainly because it feels a lot less sane and like I consider the basic tree very rational Whereas when you start getting into the mirror of the name, which is like, you know, you have the Tetragrammaton, the name of God, gets flipped with the klipo, which is literally shells, and it's actually the chetzonim, or the outside ones. And so, like, a lot of, like, conspiracy theorists like to play with that specifically, because if you go into a lot of European occultism, that's like a huge focus. So what's happened with the OTO now, so like Aleister Crowley's organization, like, now that's like a huge focus for them. And it probably was all along, but if you read Crowley, he doesn't actually focus on that as much as one might think. He's actually more focused with the tree itself. And so, but then just considering that, you know, they relate the klipo literally to darkness and chaos, and in the first lines of Genesis, when they speak about the void, and they talk about the darkness, like, God is on the face of the deep, right? And so all of these words are taken, like, anything relating to chaos or darkness is relating to the klipo, which is literally like a restrictive force. And so all the whole story of creation in Bereshit or Genesis is a infinite being wanting to create something on a limited level, but using all of its force in order to project into the abyss, basically. And so, you know, just considering that, you know, the 42 letter name of God is very important in Kabbalah, and it's literally the name is held within the Tefillin cube. So when you're doing a ritual prayer in order to, you know, kind of purify yourself, you literally, there's a practice where you strap a cube onto your head and you strap a cube onto your left arm, and you wind the strap down your arm and you wind it down your fingers, and literally within this cube that's held on your head is a piece of parchment that contains a 42 letter name, and that 42 letter name is actually derived from the first line of Genesis, and the line actually ends on the word for chaos, or I believe it's actually the void. And so it's really interesting. Yeah,
funny because that kind of came up on the Red Ice interview, which is, you know, I think it was Jason Brera discovered that Aleister Crowley said that the fingerprint of the demiurge is 42.
Yeah.
And so
exactly.
How do you square that with what you're saying in your piece?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's a very complex thing to get into. I mean, I've been looking at this particular thing for the last 6 years, and I still haven't wrapped my mind around it. I don't think you're intended to wrap your mind around it, and it's really something to, like, try and, like, rush into it. But just to basically, you know, kind of do my best to outline it, is that, you know, you basically have a mechanism that just plays itself out, and it has all these different aspects, but there's one archetypal foundation to it. And so on one level, it's perfect order. On another level, it's like, when we try and understand it, and when we try to meet it through our knowledge, like, by accumulating knowledge around this thing, it's like an infinite regression. And so it's literally, it's chaotic, but its chaos actually has a relative order, because by necessity, it has to mirror that divine perfection. And so it's the idea that there is an inherent perfection in existence that's there, but that our minds are never able to, if you were to actually, like, see it, you would literally become it. And so, like, you know, yogis would call that samadhi, right? That's like the state of liberation, is complete immersion in that perfection. And so, you know, if it's not samadhi and it's anything else other than, you know, absolute, adeptness, then you're literally, your perception is ruled by these klephotic intelligences. And so, you know, the idea that's being presented in my chapter, at least the way I'm interpreting it now, although I could go other directions with it, is that, you know, I'm considering that there's this kind of continual mutual interdependent influence of energies. And so Dionysus and Apollo represented as with Nietzsche with the birth of tragedy, but he's at pointing to a underlying reality that you have these energetic influences kind of fluctuating back and forth, and so that, you know, we're basically playing out this like infinite recursive drama, and it's breaking itself down. And if it breaks itself down all the way, then that's perfection. But usually it just keeps the cycle going. And it's like what Bill would look at Finnegan's Wake, that you're falling asleep and you're waking up, you're dying and you're coming back to life for eternity. You know, it's it's an interesting concept.
Hey, David, this is Alan here. I want to ask you a question. This seems to be the general theme of your chapter, is obviously the idea of the mirror. You know, you touch a lot on Alice in Wonderland, you know, who goes through the looking glass, all this sort of stuff. You just mentioned Nietzsche, who has this idea of the Apollo-Dionysus sort of juxtaposition. What about the fact that he also said, if you gaze into the abyss, the abyss gazes into you? So you have this idea of the Old Testament saying that the creator is basically, his face is on the abyss, he's looking in, and the abyss is looking out, and you sort of, is this what creates things? Is this what, you know, in a weird sort of way, is this not what brings about creation?
There's a really important distinction to be made, and that's that there is a very real abyss that is the void, right? And that this is a real thing that's taking place in order for things to be formed. So there's a difference between creation and making things. And our knowledge, which is literally, you know, like Babel, like we're constructing through consensus agreement, we're projecting a reality. And this is the tree of knowledge, as opposed to the tree of life. And so you know, it's necessary only temporarily, ultimately, is, you know, is what's proposed, is that this is basically in order to develop, there's kind of a required stepping back, like it's like you have to remove yourself in order to develop, like, but it's, I don't know, it's an interesting idea. I don't know if any, it's I mean, it's common throughout all different philosophies. You see it everywhere. And like, that's the value of theosophy, is that there's no there's a freedom to look from all different angles and all different ways, you know, and I appreciate that attempt, you know. But I don't completely know how to answer that in words necessarily. It's more something to be meditated on, but we're on a show, and so I'll do my best.
Well, so the connective thread that really runs through this, that I've discerned, is James Douglas Morrison. And what this epigram, is this a poem from The American Prayer?
Oh, which epigram is that?
It's what is connection? When two motions thought to be infinite and mutually exclusive meet in a moment of time. Is that a Morrison poem?
It is, yeah. So I look at Morrison as like a, he is definitely an early synchromistic, as far as like our contemporary culture is concerned. So like as far as pop culture goes, he's a very early synchromistic, and you can see that expressed throughout his poetry, and it's very blatant. The Lords. So he did the Lords and the New Creatures, and the Lords is a kind of looking at film as in through a mystical lens, and so it's extremely deep. And I could only imagine, like, if you know, certain directors were to like look at that. I you know, directors I really appreciate. I could only imagine, like, Lars von Trier, you know, obviously Kubrick or something. I could see them really like resonating with that particular work. So yeah, I mean, the idea, even the windows work two ways, mirrors one, comes from the Lords. So, and I like, he's like, you can't, what does he say? You can't swim through mirrors. You can't, basically that, I don't know. I was having this difficulty with when we were talking about you're looking at a mirror, which is giving you a representation of yourself, or that there could be an actual like a continuum or a paradox, right? So you have duality, which could be looked at as a conflict or a dual, or you could have a duality, which is actually a polarity. And like I said, a continuum, like an undivided spectrum of being. And so that's the distinction that's being made between the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. On one level, you're talking about something that is literally a continuum. And on another, you're talking about something that by necessity has to be against itself. And that's also kind of how I take the clefotic tree, of the outside ones kind of like making their own tree, which is their own matrix, and projecting that. And that's literally like what we perceive when we experience things as limited. Like that's, you know, the doors itself comes from Aldous Huxley. When the doors of perception are cleansed, you know, things will appear to man as they are, which is infinite. And that's the idea. If they don't appear as infinite, then we're not really seeing them. And then the question is, what then are we seeing? And so
I was just going to say, and then you have this quote in here, one makes oneself a visionary by a long, immense, ordered derangement of the senses. And it sounds like something that Jim Morrison quoted.
That's from Blake. So the Doors comes from Blake. And so, I mean, the name, the Doors, comes from Blake's Heaven and Hell. So, and that's literally, I mean, that right before that, in that work, he's talking about the tree of life when the, you know, the cycle has come to an end and the caribou. It's that man must till the field before he can partake of the tree of life is literally what it has to say in the Torah. And so the idea of tilling the field is literally tilling the scripture. So you can't just read it. You have to work it, you know, and that means that it's an interactive thing. And so what I'm trying to do with film and music and like coming across, like exploring to the point where I can find things that I literally cannot explain, like the degrees of synchronicity that occur, is basically approaching these things as I would approach scripture. So I'm literally doing my best to, like, you know, till through them and overturn them and interact with them and not just be a spectator, which I think is what we're all kind of doing in the synchromistic community, is we're trying to interact with these art forms instead of just, you know, kind of stepping back and being like, oh yeah, that's cool, I like what they did there, you know.
If you're talking about what you've been doing with film and music and trying to actually till the soil of these artworks and the knowledge around them, I'd like to bring in Andras Jones, because he's someone who has quickly become a huge fan of the kind of work you do, and I'd like to bring him into the conversation to see what he has to say about your work.
Well, I'm not just a fan, but like also just the best kind of fanship to me is people, artists who inspire me. And you are definitely an artist who inspires me. And just even just what you were just talking about, I wanted to just hop, before we hop into talking about your, what I think is really just very central work with Rosemary's White Album. There were a couple things that I noticed in what you were saying. Forgive me, but I have a totally different interaction with the Kabbalistic tree, which is fully experiential. But first of all, I noticed that several times in your conversation earlier, you said by necessity, by necessity, by necessity. And what I heard you saying was bina or bina. So there's a whole level of understanding that I think resonates with. That's why, that's what I love about your take on film, is that it is, and I think that the whole sync, it resonates with the central theme of the sync movement, if there is understanding of getting things. And also, just really, I thought I had a deep understanding of Morrison, but you sent me on a path to really check out some of the written work. So I'm really looking forward to checking that out. And then the whole idea of a lineage from Blake to Huxley to Morrison is something that I hadn't quite connected. So those are all really salient points and interesting things. But I want to talk about Rosemary's White Album with you because that's an obsession we share.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to tell people what Rosemary's White Album is?
It's playing the Beatles' White Album over the film Rosemary's Baby, which is something that I became inspired to due to watching Marilyn Manson's album Holy, Alejandro Jodorowsky start Hollywood at the moment that Alejandro Jodorowsky's name disappears. And I did this as a kind of just a creative experiment, and it was after the fact that I found that they were actually very close friends and spent a lot of time together, and then read quotes from Jodorowsky saying that this particular album was the most important thing Marilyn Manson had done in his life. And, you know, and so, but it was literally the sets of clues within that particular sync that led me to try this, which is strange, but that's what it was.
Well, that's the thing that I'm interested in, because when, as you were talking about Lennon and this lineage, or sort of Lennon is one of the original synchromystics, I think that the other one has to be Lennon.
Sure. Yeah.
More probably more so than any other, than anyone else.
Right. Well, John Lennon actually was the person who helped Alejandro Jodorowsky's film The Holy Mountain be produced, because there was a tragedy that occurred where most of that film got destroyed, and he was the one who came through with money and didn't even want his name attached to it. And it's hard to find that information. I actually found it in a audio commentary to Alejandro Jodorowsky's Fondo and Liz, where he just says that. And I'm just like, wow, okay.
Bringing it to the back to Rosemary's Baby, because this is Rosemary's White album. This is the thing that I think is so powerful about that, is that Rosemary's Baby is such an iconic film, in the same way that Wizard of Oz is an iconic movie, and the White Album is an iconic album in the same way that Dark Side of the Moon is, but even kind of more so, like, in a different way, Rosemary's Baby is much more primal, and in another way, the White Album is much more universal and archetypal. And it contains the same kind of historical sinks that you're talking about with Jodorowsky and Holy Mountain and Hollywood and Marilyn Manson, but that I think everyone who could listen to this podcast has some concept of what Rosemary's Baby is and has seen it, and the White Album, you could say the same, less so with there are many other great films and movies and music that you can connect, but there's something particular about that one. And this is what I'm really interested in talking with you about. What do you think or if you agree with me, do you think that there is something that is particularly resonant about that one because of the universal factor?
Well, what's really kind of crazy is that a lot of what leads me to this is studying occult influences, where I often find out after the fact how they influence particular artists. And so I have a personal feeling, which is not verified, it's not empirical, but I look at Kenneth Grant's work in the OTO, and I feel that there's a direct connection with his particular view of Thelema and the way he approaches Crowley's ideas that the Beatles were into. And there's just it's been a resonance that I'm really beginning to recognize more. But there's this thing, like, I'm looking at my chapter here and I'm realizing that, like, one of the greatest values of it is, and not just my own, but like people who are working on similar lines, is that it kind of inspires people to go in different avenues, directions that they might not otherwise. Like, if I wanted to if I'm going to sit down and watch Rosemary's White Album again for myself, I feel like I would want to read a little bit more of Kenneth Grant's work to approach it through that lens and to kind of gain different kinds of insight in it.
Well, can you tell, like, I have so many favorite moments from Rosemary's White Album when you connect them. Can you talk about one of your favorite moments from it? Just like a sync between one of the songs, because this is so iconic that we could actually do this on the radio without actually playing it. You can say this scene in this movie and this song.
I love it when Dear Prudence starts. I love it when they close the elevator and Dear Prudence kicks in.
I'm so with you on that. I love it. Yes.
Because Prudence Farrow is Mia Farrow's sister. She's meditating with the Beatles right before the Beatles White Album is released, you know, and she goes into a depression and doesn't want to leave her room. And she wouldn't call it a depression. She'd call it, I mean, this is their interpretation of her experience, of course, which is, you could argue it's a judgment.
Yeah, I do think it. I agree. I'm so glad you're saying this. Yes.
So as she's walking around and saying, Dear Prudence, but then when I'm watching this the first time, the immediate thing that came to me is I really have spent a lot of time with the Thoth deck of Crowley's. And so I think Prudence, I think the eight of
exactly
this, which is the sun in Virgo, which is literally the phallus impregnating the virgin. And so, and that's the symbolism of the card. And so I'm just like, dude, that's, oh my God, like, there you go. And yeah, I mean, I like it when she writes on the calendar later on, when Mia Farrow writes blood on, what does she do? Okay, so she puts an X on the fourth day of the month. And then she flips the calendar on the other side. It's like the fifth, and she writes blood. I forget exactly how it happened.
You know what's so funny?
Because she writes the name. Doesn't she write the name, like Andrew or something? And you said the name means blood or?
Dom means blood. So Dom in Hebrew means blood, and its value in Gematria is 45. And for me, like, I look at that. Basically, what there was is there's this connection between 45 and blood that she's just doing directly in red. And it's just, and that's Adam. So the Adam in the garden is literally Aleph in blood. So it's a life breath or spirit in blood. And so for me, I'm looking at that and I'm like, that's not an accident. Like, I mean, it could be, but it doesn't feel that way to me. And so there's this inevitable like thing that comes up where when you're looking at this stuff and it reaches a certain crescendo, it just, it calls like, it makes you question, first of all, your sanity, because then when you're showing it to somebody, you feel like, you know, you want to express that this is profound. And then it's like, but then it's a personal thing too, because like for me, I'm looking at that and that's the result of my study. If I tell it to somebody after the fact, it's interesting, but it's great. Like if I show it to my rabbi and he sees it before I tell him, you know, and then we're on the same page. It's like, well, yeah, there it is, you know, and I like that, you know, occultism works like that. It's like we have a shared understanding of a set of correspondences. Those correspondences are being projected, you know, so there's always the question, and there's any line that's between what's intended and what's not is always a line in the sand, you know. And
okay, so this is a really good question. And Alan, who's doing timekeeping here? Where are we at, Doug? Where are we at on time?
We got 28 minutes into our 42 minutes.
Oh, so we got, okay. So this is great. Because you brought this up. So I wrote my book. You mentioned it, Doug, at the beginning that you have a blog about it. So I'm going to use this as an opportunity to reference it. But it's about the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, but I'm not a scholar, but it's about my experience with an actual Kabbalistic Tree of Life that was built into my town. And it initiated me in some strange and accidental ways. And I wrote about it. And then I was talking about this, and then someone wrote to me a critical email saying that there was a tree of life and a tree of death. And you're talking about a tree of life and a tree of knowledge. And tree of death?
Yeah, it's the Klephotic tree is technically, it's an extension of Da'at. So Da'at being knowledge. And so it's what comes in. The Chetzonim, or the outside ones, are what like basically take over the tree when the tree of life is split. And so as the tree is divided, it opens it up to these other forces. And those forces then rule our perceptions. It's a trippy idea, but that's essentially what it is.
I guess that's one of the interesting things about Rosemary's White Album, bringing it back to that, is that Rosemary's Baby is consciously, it's not consciously intending Rosemary's White Album or the awful things that happen to, are going to happen to Roman Polanski or John Lennon after the fact. But because they're great artists, their deaths, their tragedies, their lives are encoded into their work. And then a way their work is that, like, is Rosemary's White Album just like a massive tree of knowledge slash death writ large so that we can all see the folly of doing great work? Or is it a part of the tree of life? Because I'm actually struggling with this, the duality here, because I don't see a duality. I don't think Sync is about a duality.
Not. Absolutely not. And so basically the idea is that your perception of, if you're trying to interpret the tree, is never the tree. Like, in the same way that the tree is directly from the Ein Sof, right? So you have the light in extension, the tree is an emanation of it. And this is the wiring underneath our board of perception, right? And so there's that has a reality, but that our perception never touches that through knowledge. And so, and literally the knowledge itself is taken as skin. So it's really interesting. So like Adam and Eve, when they get expelled from the garden, they literally put on skin. So the Kabbalists, particularly Ramak, equates this is trippy, but that when they put on the skin, they're also putting on the klipot. So the klipot are literally something that we wear. So that when, in the first place, like this was on Two Virgins of John Lennon and Yoko, right, where they're naked on cover, and then it has a quote from the Torah where it says, Adam and Eve were naked, we're not ashamed. That's prior to the eating of the tree. After the tree, they're like, they're ashamed of being naked. And Adonai says, who told you you were naked? In other words, being naked is a belief.
Moonchild, could you explain to our audience that Rosemary's Baby, Aleister Crowley, John Lennon connection? What is the Moonchild, and you know, why are they trying to manifest this thing?
Well, the Rosemary's Baby would be like a byproduct of the Moonchild. Not just Rosemary's Baby, but Rosemary's White Album. So along with a whole lot of other things, right? So basically the result of a lot of intense work being done, it's the great work. And so everyone's literally contributing to it. But then you have people kind of like taking the initiative to direct it the way that they'd like to see it. And so it's a theory, okay? And it's a psychedelic theory, literally. And so I can't help but recognize an incredible degree of synchronicities between the atomic bomb and LSD. And I'm not the first to see this. And the thing is like my chapter, I'm explaining that this was Albert Hoffman's belief. So the person who discovered LSD in the first place didn't feel that he discovered anything. He looked at LSD as literally an intelligence that basically was called into existence to take form as basically like an elemental through us splitting the atom. And so, you know, synchronistically or symbolically speaking, I look at the atom as the Adam. And not even, it's like, even if it wasn't called that, I would still be seeing that link. Most likely because the parallels are so uncanny in terms of that you have an order that exists that's completely like it's in rotation, it's in movement, and it exists in complete compensation so that every point is compensated on another, yet it's moving so rapidly. And so that's basically what's described in the Zohar as the tree. And so when you consider that the tree is literally not meant to be as it's represented now, but literally folded into itself as a completely balanced figure. And when the atom is split, there's something that is formed. And so what was formed? And so this is a complex thing, but you have Jack Parsons, who was the head of JPL or Jet Propulsion Lab, he's the guy who designed and built all the rocket boosters for the ships of the Apollo missions that took us to the moon, right? And so he's working with L. Ron Hubbard to create the head of the person who made Scientology, which people don't take seriously, which they're right to do so, beside the point. Diuretics is beside the point, but like his work on the Moonchild working is interesting stuff to look at, you know. And I don't know what his exact I don't know. We don't know exactly what went on. We just know that they're very serious about this working. And then it's literally when they, when people take it as that they're producing a golem, like just like the Chetzonim or the Klipot, which people are feel are very demonic. It's they're literally blind forces. And so the idea of a golem is that you're producing something in form, yet a lot of the descriptions that are older, like people have assumptions about what it means, and they visualize like Gollum from Lord of the Rings, like this weird creature. Yet there's no reason to suggest that this Gollum was meant to be incarnate, or if it was incarnate, that it would be in a, like a human form or like a creature form even. And so I was just considering, due to all of these synchronicities, just the idea that lysergic acid diethylamide could actually be this Gollum.
You mentioned the idea of it being a blind force, but actually Jack Parsons in the Babylon Working, he makes reference to this Dionysian Apollo dichotomy that we opened the show with. And he says that he thought that the Moonchild would bring an end to the blind and uncontrolled nature of things, and it would actually be a focused and intelligent use of these forces.
Thank you. Totally. And so, and that's when he actually makes a direct connection between like Horus and Dionysus. So he has as this Apollo Dionysus connection is you can extrapolate from his Babylon Working, which is basically he's essentially looking at this eon of Horus as a Horus energy as a initially a blind force, and that we're like Horus the Younger, where we haven't learned to wield our power appropriately. And that ultimately, this is the idea, is that when we do, it is directed force. And so, I mean, this is the definition of magic with a K, is the idea that you're moving nature in accordance with the will. So you're not doing anything necessarily against nature. You're just playing with nature. And the way to do so, and it's acknowledging that nature exists on dense levels and etheric levels, and you can affect change on etheric levels that on one level are very subtle, yet in their development are very gross.
Can I ask a question which is a bit playful but a bit serious as well? You and I on Always Record, we've discussed many times the connection between Oz and the Tree of Life, the Adam as the Tree of Life, that so the split Adam is the split tree, the connection between Alice in Wonderland and Dorothy going to Oz, Oz being, of course, this force, all these things being connected, right? But, you know, we have the fact that Frank L. Baum, who writes The Wizard of Oz, his last name, Baum, in German means tree. You know, we have these weird sort of things. Now, the kind of artwork you're doing not only is making references to all these other things, but in a weird sort of way, the film album sync that everyone is so familiar with is Wizard of Oz, Dark Side of the Moon. So here you have the Oz, the Wizard of Oz being, in a sense, this sort of lunar resonance, the tree resonance with the dark side of the moon. And so this is almost what it spawns out of. This is almost an accidental, if we want to consider that, the Wizard of Oz, Dark Side of the Moon sync is almost the accidental pairing of this art form or spawning of this art form. And now we've come almost full circle where a Rosemary's White album, which would also very much resonate with a Moon Child, but instead it's a directed, a willful playing with this art form. Can you speak to that?
Totally. Yeah, I also love that Jack Parsons has a crater for him named after him on the Dark Side of the Moon, which is kind of ironic in a very interesting way. But yeah, no, totally. I mean, I feel like the act of silencing a film and playing an album over it is, first of all, I equate it with the way that the Greek theater was represented in The Birth of Tragedy, that you would literally have a satyr chorus that was drowning out the play that everyone was familiar with. People would go to see plays and they would have these satyrs in between them and the viewing that is literally musical, and that it's portraying the subtext and the subliminal thought going on for the characters. And that was Nietzsche's idea there. And so I really feel like there's, when we're doing this kind of work is actually a ritual that goes way back. It's the same principle being applied. And in the same way, like, I mean, William S. Burroughs showed John Lennon, you know, let's play phonograph records backwards. I mean, this was said in an interview with John Lennon at one point, that early on in their career, he's hanging out with Burroughs in a basement, and Burroughs is a Thelemite. And so where did he get that idea? But from Crowley. Crowley recommended playing phonograph records backwards, learning to speak backwards. And that completely relates to the Chatzonim as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh backwards, being the four klipot. And so it gets really, really interesting, really, really fast if you start down this rabbit hole. And so
you know what? What's really strange about this, and maybe you'll agree with me on this, David, is that there's something about there's a as you're talking about this, I keep thinking about John Cage. Yeah, I just keep thinking about John Cage back out here in the Northwest, who's not a part of any order. All he did was take mushrooms and listen to music, and he came up with all the same crazy shit. And there's something that attaches itself to the spookiness, and it there's nothing spooky about any of this, right? I mean, other than the fact that we all die.
Sure, it's very misleading because I'm here using terms from Kabbalah and talking about Kabbalah, but you can go into any system and find it, because these are universal archetypal things that we're discussing. And so it just so happens that people have arranged systems to communicate these ideas, but these ideas are like inherent in our very like perceptual structure. And if you go deep enough energetically, you come upon the same kind of angles. And so, yeah.
Thank you. You've been listening to David Plate on 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com. More information about the work of Mr. Plate can be found at beingthere723.blogspot.com. For more information about the SyncBook, our guests, to check out past shows, or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit the website at thesyncbook.com/42minutes. If you like what you hear and would like to support the show, by all means, follow the link on the website to the donation page. Thank you, and have a wonderful Tuesday. Oh, and please be sure and check out the Radio Free Albemuth Kickstarter. Thanks, David.
Got it.